Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Brian Morris, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me this morning from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Patrick Cassidy. He's news editor of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
And joining us a bit later, we'll be talking to Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll also hear from Sam Houghton, who will be in the studio. Sam's with the Mashpee Enterprise. Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette will be checking in. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Jim DeRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times. And also George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's take a look at some of the news on the Cape and Islands. And Patrick, you know, one of the big week's big stories, of course, is the grounding of that Steamship Authority high-speed ferry, Ayano, that happened just about a week ago tonight. And we heard yesterday that the captain and the pilot of the vessel have now both been placed on paid administrative leave. Any sense on where we are yet with any of the answers as to what might have caused the crash?
Well, we're not far with any of those answers. The Coast Guard is investigating this incident. The National Transportation Safety Board the other day said that they would not be part of the investigation. They're usually involved in transportation-related incidents, crashes, accidents, fatal plane crashes, typically. But they said they look at whether there was loss of life and the extent of the damage. Nobody died in this. There were 15 people injured. And as your listeners may know, the ferry essentially hit the Hyannisport breakwater on Friday night and was lodged up on the breakwater. It hit it hard enough to really get up on top of it. And it was quite a while as passengers and crew members were taken off that vessel. There were 48 passengers and I believe six crew members and three food service people on board. It was quite an operation. The local Hyannis Fire Department was out on the scene. The U.S. Coast Guard brought in a helicopter and hoisted, I believe, 10 people off the vessel. I think it was 15, actually. Five were injuries, and 10 people were people who couldn't get onto the rocks. But in any case, we haven't heard a whole lot about what might have caused this. It usually takes a turn as it comes into Hyannis Harbor there.
Yeah, and it was right up against the rock, you know, at a right angle. It just looks, I know it takes that big turn, but it's strange how it ended up the way it did.
Well, it just went straight is what happened. I mean, whatever the cause was, the vessel continued straight for another several thousand feet. I think it was before it hit the breakwater. And again, we haven't heard anything. Just now, as you said, in the last day or so, they said that the captain and the pilot were put on paid administrative leave. There were a lot of questions right after it happened as to why that didn't happen immediately. Usually when you have a crash involving like a police officer or somebody in a position like that, they're put on leave while the investigation goes on. So it took about 5 days or more for them to come out with that information. They said those folks haven't been on a boat since the incident. But there's still a lot of questions out there as to how this could have happened and what right. went wrong.
And the vessel is now undergoing repairs in Fairhaven. Any sense, Patrick, on how long those repairs could take?
They could take a while. They say based on initial estimates, the vessel is expected to be out for 3 to 4 weeks. Obviously, it's at a point in the season, the start of the summer season, where they really need all the capacity they can coming up to 4th of July.
Sure.
So they've brought in a couple of high-speed ferries from Sea Streak, another ferry company that they've chartered to do trips back and forth to the island.
Also in the news, we heard earlier reports that two Cape Cod men had died from the tick-borne Powassan virus, but now state health officials have not officially confirmed that. It's kind of a confusing story there.
Yes, absolutely. With public information on health issues, you would hope that there would be as much information as possible out there. The State Department of Public Health says in this case that they're erring on the side of protecting privacy of individuals. Powassan is a tick-borne disease. We obviously know about Lyme. We know about anaplasmosis and babesiosis and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, all these tick-borne diseases. This is not a new disease, but it's relatively new in terms of people hearing about it and some of the deaths that have occurred in Massachusetts and across the country in recent years. And so, again, when we heard, our reporter Cindy McCormick heard from the Barnstable County entomologist Larry Dapsis that two men on the Cape, one from Falmouth and one from Sandwich, had died this year after contracting Powassan, we immediately wanted to get more information and share that information with our readers. The state at that time, and this was June 7th when he said that, wouldn't confirm or deny those deaths or any specific information about those men. And so we were kind of left in this information vacuum. They later said they shared some information, including that there were 13 confirmed Powassan infections between 2013 and 2016, and one in 2015 and two in 2016 in the state. And they also have confirmed that there were deaths, but again, they won't specify where those deaths occurred specifically. And they also say that the way they account for deaths could, well, we think it could confuse things. The way they account for deaths is if you become sick in, say, 2016 and you die in 2017, then that counts as a 2016 death. So, oh. Again, further confuses things. So these two deaths that we're told by the county health official occurred in 2017, according to people who knew these men, they may have actually been people who are counted in 2016, according to the state statistics. So, again, a lot of questions. We continue to ask the Department of Public Health for some of these answers. They say that, again, they're worried about privacy. There are so few of these cases. And if they start providing identifying information, that these people's privacy would be invaded. But, you know, you got to weigh that against certainly the public health aspects of this and question why there wouldn't be at least some information. We're right. Not asking ourselves for their names, for example. But that may come out, you know, in other ways. Mm-hmm. And we're just asking for the basic information where it was so people can start to think about it. They say it doesn't matter where it is because Powassan, as it turns out, looks like it may be everywhere. But perhaps that's even more reason to be getting the information out there to the public and have the public prepared to look at that as a possible diagnosis, or local health officials look at that as a diagnosis. So we'll continue to follow this and ask these questions.
All right. Reporter Sam Houghton from the Mashpee Enterprise joins us in the studio this morning. Good morning, Sam.
Right.
And Sam, of course, big breaking story here from yesterday. Camp Farley in Mashpee has lost its 4-H designation amid quite a bit of fallout from a sex scandal.
Yeah, it hasn't been the greatest story. But right, 4-H administered by UMass, they give that to a number of camps around Massachusetts. You know, in my eyes, people we've spoken to, this is 4-H, you know, gives reassurances to parents that, you know, this is a safe camp. This is, you know, run by, or, you know, has a distinction from UMass. People at UMass withdrew that, but right, this started in March. The camp's executive director, Michael Campbell, had been kind of caught in a sting. He had offered to pay for sex to what happened to be undercover officers. And as time went on, he remained as the executive director of the camp. The board of managers had met and I guess decided to keep him on. As time went on, board members slowly resigned, and we were actually forwarded some of their resignations letters last week. And even up until June, they've decided to keep him on as executive director. So the kind of the statement that we've gotten from UMass as to why they withdrew the 4-H, it's not just that Mr. Campbell, you know, went through this, sex sting or mm-hmm. whatnot. It's also that the board, well, from what they said, it's kind of a lack of oversight for the board of managers. So it seems, you know, when you get a statement from an institution like UMass, it's very vague, but you know, it shows that there has been, you know. And we've also spoken with members of the board saying that there has been kind of poor oversight, poor management of the situation. When a situation like this, when a high-profile person goes through a criminal charge, generally you put them on administrative leave or fire them. That has not happened.
Yeah. Also, the big question about whether the lack of that 4-H designation will, you know, make people less likely to sign their kids up for the camp.
Right. It's kind of another sting for the camp. I mean, having an executive director go through that and now losing the 4-H program, it's just not a great news for the camp.
All right, Sam.
Here, Brian, if I can. Yeah, obviously, these are still allegations against Mr. Campbell. The case is still ongoing. But the other thing that we learned yesterday was that they had eliminated his position at the camp. They say they've eliminated the executive director position, but he's still on as a consultant. So even as they take this step that some people, you know, presume would have been taken at the beginning here of taking him out of the mix, they're still keeping him on as a consultant. They're saying that he's there strictly to answer questions. But again, there are a lot of the questions that need to be answered as to how this board functions aren't being answered. And again, I know both Sam and us are asking those questions.
All right,
yeah,
Patrick.
They are looking to hire somebody else going forward. But
all right. Thanks for the clarification on that, Patrick. Sam Houghton is a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. He joined us in our Woods Hole studio this morning. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Brian.
Let's go now to Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, are you there?
Good morning. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. The early morning freight runs between Woods Hole and the Vineyard are sort of in the spotlight at the moment as some Woods Hole Road folks are upset about the truck noise early in the morning.
Yeah, and I think this has been an issue for a while. This is not a new concern. And the truck traffic, you know, the brakes and all that noise pretty early in the morning, you know, 5-6 in the morning sometimes. And that is, like you said, a source of concern for people living along that road. And this week, it was the main subject at a public hearing held over in Falmouth at the library there before the Steamship Authority Board of Governors. And there was a petition that had been signed by, I think, 61 Falmouth residents opposing the proposed schedule for next winter and spring, particularly the early morning freight trips that are on that schedule. And so they called for a public hearing to address those concerns. I guess about 90 people were there, so a pretty big turnout. A lot of Falmouth residents, a lot of the people concerned, also Vineyard residents, and people, you know, over in Woods Hole and along the road said they really, it's a quality of life issue for them. They lose sleep because of these early trips. Someone read a letter from State Representative Dylan Fernandez, who said he's received a record number of complaints about freight traffic at his office.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly something that a lot of people are very concerned about. And meanwhile, you know, some Vineyard residents were there too, who said, you know, that the early morning freight service is important. They said really for both sides, for people who need to get off the island, people who live on the mainland need to go on the island. It's a lifeline for people who, you know, need to commute early in the morning, and also people, you know, obviously these freight trips that bring things over here. So as far as, you know, what to do, you know, a lot of people suggested eliminating these early trips, which is one thing. The other option that has come up pretty frequently in the last, you know, recently and even going back for a long time is the idea of establishing freight service to New Bedford.
Right.
So the idea of exploring, you know, going that direction instead of to Woods Hole. And the Steamship Authority has done feasibility studies. I think they're doing a new study now on doing maybe trash and freight service to New Bedford. They said, you know, the cost would be prohibitively high, they said, to build a new terminal in New Bedford. There are other restrictions on the use of an existing pier there, so it would not be necessarily an easy thing to do, is what the Steamship Authority General Manager has said. So you know, it's not, there's clearly not an easy fix here. And, you know, members of the Board of Governors didn't really comment at the meeting this week. The board is expected to meeting next week in Nantucket for the regular meeting. It sounds like it's not on the agenda for that meeting, but General Manager Wayne Lamson, who is retiring very shortly, he said he expects there will be a final report on the schedule in a few weeks. Okay. So they'll deliver their report on this issue.
All right. Sarah Brown, news editor with the Vineyard Gazette. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Of course. Thank you.
Okay. And Patrick, very briefly, the recently formed Pilgrim Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel got off to a bit of a rocky start, but it looks like things may have smoothed out just a bit.
Yes, their first meeting, I believe, last month was kind of a mess, to be honest with you. The chair of that meeting or during that meeting was somebody from the Department of Public Utilities, and she didn't want anybody to decide on future meetings, and she basically didn't want to decide on leadership for the panel, which has been formed to look at decommissioning of the plant in Plymouth after it closes as scheduled in 2019, assuming that goes forward. And so this panel, which is composed of people from the company that owns Pilgrim Energy, of residents, of state officials, hadn't really gotten going until this last meeting, which was actually called by a number of members who used a part of the provision that set up the group to call their own meeting. You know, it wasn't called by the chair and it wasn't called by the group in the first place. So they called this separate meeting, and apparently everybody showed up. They got to work. They chose new leadership. They chose a couple co-chairmen, a local businessman in Plymouth, and the head of the Massachusetts Emergency Planning Agency or Emergency Management Agency to be co-chairman and alternate going forward. And they decided to have meetings every third Wednesday or every third Wednesday of the month for all months except for August and December. They started talking about subcommittees. So they look like they're moving forward. People, our reporter Christine Legere, who's been covering this issue closely, talked to, said that it was smooth, that it was cordial, and that things are back on track.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right, you're listening to the Friday News Roundup here on WCAI. We're going to take a short break right now. We'll have more of the Roundup when we return. Welcome back. This is the Friday News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Brian Morris, and with me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Patrick Cassidy, news editor of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. We're going to go right now to Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
How are you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great. Tim, Chatham lost a well-respected member of its maritime community this week, and authorities still don't know exactly what happened.
That's exactly right. Longtime tour boat operator, Captain David Murdoch, died Monday afternoon in what is apparently been described as a boating accident. Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office is still investigating what happened, but they say there's nothing suspicious, no foul play suspected in this. It just appears to have been an unfortunate accident. Police received a call around 4 p.m. Monday afternoon reporting an overdue boater, and shortly thereafter, Mr. Murdoch's dinghy was found on the tip of North Beach Island, and his body was discovered on the southern end of North Beach. Now, that's at either end of the North Inlet here in the Outer Beach in Chatham. They're investigating now how that might have happened. Now, Mr. Murdoch was a fixture around the waterfront here, was well known in town also for driving a blue Jeep with a large American flag flying on the back. And he had spent summers growing up in Harwich, been on the water his whole life, moved here full-time in 1970 and was a successful commercial photographer in Hyannis before starting his Chatham Water Tour business in 1997. Which he continued to operate up until just the time of his death. He was an active volunteer in town. He was in the schools. He was active with the Women of Fishing Families Organization, which his daughter-in-law helped organize. And he's certainly someone who will be very missed in town in a number of different facets of the community. And police and district attorney's office tell us they hope to know more about the circumstances of his death and perhaps the cause after an autopsy is performed and they do a little bit more investigating. So we'll be following that story.
And memorial service, I think, this Monday, correct?
This week, right.
Yeah, okay.
This Monday.
Also, Tim, we've been talking about that ferry accident last week where some people had to be airlifted off the jetty in that really precarious helicopter operation. You guys have a report this week about a new smartphone app that could help with those types of scenarios.
That's exactly right, Brian. This is it's an app called I Am Responding, and it's going to be in use hopefully beginning July 4th by local emergency responders, and it's going to be coordinated by the Coast Guard. Basically, this app allows the Coast Guard to send out a notification that there is some sort of an emergency, and responders can just press a button to say that they're on their way, that they're responding to this. And it's going to be used by harbor masters and other emergency responders in the area. Now, this would have been something that, as you said, would have been useful for the accident, the ferry accident in Hyannis last weekend, because the Coast Guard, in that case, they have to make a lot of calls to summon a lot of help that they need for an incident like that. With this app, theoretically, the way it's supposed to work, they will be able to press one single button, send out a notification, and everybody in the network will know what is needed, and they can inform the Coast Guard whether or not they're responding. The apparently this is in use already in New Bedford and Rhode Island, and the harbor masters around here tell us that they've heard good reports about it. And so they're, as I said, they're expected to deploy it here July 4th and be able to utilize it this summer for a whole range of emergencies, not just search and rescue, but law enforcement, pollution responses, that sort of thing.
All right. There's an app for that, right, Tim?
There's an app for everything, apparently.
All right. Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. News editor Patrick Cassidy is joining us from the newsroom at the Cape Cod Times. And Patrick, the town of Falmouth has now been ordered to shut down both of its wind turbines. This has been the cause of a long-running dispute.
Yeah, it certainly has been long-running. These turbines are at the Falmouth Wastewater Treatment Facility, for anybody who hasn't kept up with this, and it's hard to believe somebody wouldn't have heard about this. But neighbors have long said that the turbines are a nuisance, that they cause health issues, that they're an annoyance, that they make it difficult for them to enjoy their property. And there's been a number of lawsuits. I think there are 9 total legal cases, some of them involving the town, you know, basically suing itself and neighbors suing the town about the turbines. In the latest case, a Barnstable Superior Court judge on Tuesday ordered that both turbines be shut down. One of the turbines had already been shut down as part of another case, and the second turbine had been curtailed to these kind of 12-hour increments of running. And this basically ruling goes against a ruling that had come earlier where a jury had said that the turbines aren't a nuisance. So you can see these conflicting legal cases playing out.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. The selectmen had an emergency meeting and they had asked the town manager to follow the judge's order. So those turbines are presumably not spinning right now. But they're going to have a meeting on Monday and go into executive session to decide what to do next. Presumably, there may be some avenue of appeal here, but this is, you know, again, another legal case. There's still others out there. It's hard to believe that this is still going on and that these cases are still playing out, but I think we'll have more to come in the future.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go on the phone with us right now is Josh Bowling, managing editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
And Josh, in addition to the folks here on the Cape, lots of folks on Nantucket affected by that ferry crash last weekend. How are people adjusting, especially at this busy time of year?
As best they can, I suppose. You know, they're still waiting to hear if and when a larger boat may be put on the schedule. Nantucketers are used to change. They're used to vagaries in the boat schedules, especially in the off season, not necessarily in the summertime. There's obviously it's been the talk of the town since last Friday night. What exactly happened here? The boat lines are a way of life for us. We use them. You know, the late Grace Grossman once said that the Steamship Authority is our lifeline to the mainland, and she was right. And that used to be just the slow boats. Now it's the fast boats as well. And when something like this happens, not only does it affect the practical parts of our daily lives, but we really, you know, sort of need to know what happened. And we're still a little up in the air on that. The investigation continues, and Coast Guard is trying to get to the bottom of it. The Steamship Authority is trying to get to the bottom of it. As most people know, the captain and the pilot who were on the bridge at the time have been placed on paid leave. The Steamship Authority has said that it does not appear that mechanical or navigational error was to blame, but they haven't released any other possible causes at the moment. We're just waiting to see, hopefully, as the busy 4th of July weekend approaches, that the Steamship Authority can put a larger boat on. The INO was capable of carrying just under 400 passengers. The boat they have on now carries 149, so there's not too much of a problem now. They're meeting the reservations, but in another week, as schools have gotten out and the 4th of July approaches, there's going to be a lot more people trying to get to the island with less capacity unless they can find another boat.
Right. And speaking of the 4th of July, just very briefly here, the crazy weekend is almost here, and how is the island going about getting ready?
As they have the last couple of years, it is a crazy weekend. It's been a crazy weekend and week, even sometimes stretching to 3 to almost 5 days here on Nantucket. Much like the Memorial Day weekend and Fagawi sailboat race, Nantucket has become a go-to destination for the 4th of July for not only families who come for sort of the more old-fashioned activities like the fireworks and the Main Street water fight, but for younger people who have descended on the beaches, the South Shore beaches in particular, for the last 10 years or so, had some pretty massive parties out there that have led to a lot of concern among town officials. The last couple of years, they've put plans in place to do the best they can to control and maintain those beach parties. A lot of police checkpoints are going to be in place again this year. They're going to be limiting the amount of alcohol that can be carried onto the beach, checking IDs, putting checkpoints again in place at various roads to prohibit vehicles from going down certain roads to access the beach, and carefully counting the number of cars on the beach, all in an attempt to let people enjoy the beaches, but to prevent any unsafe behavior or activity from happening. A couple of years ago, thankfully there were no serious injuries or any major property damage, but it got to the point where town officials said they just had enough. There was numerous incidents of trespass.
Pretty rowdy, yeah. All right, Josh Brawley, managing editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go now to Ann Wood. She's editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Brian. Hi, Patrick. How's it going?
Great, Ann.
All right. And Ann, voters have rejected the purchase of a pretty hotly contested piece of property in Provincetown.
Right. It's been a big week for the Riley family. The Riley Brothers Realty property at 132-134 Bradford Street and 10 Commercial Street was sort of under the gun on Monday. A special town meeting was called by petition by resident Barbara Rushmore, who wanted the town to purchase the property, which has 405 parking spaces on it in a building, a large building, for the town to run as a municipal parking lot and to put a police station there. The Riley family has said over and over again that it's not for sale, not for any price. So on Monday night, voters went out, 358 voters headed to town meeting, and fewer than 10 hands went up in favor of the petition. So the idea of the town buying a property that wasn't for sale went down, and so did the idea of eminent domain. The Rileys were worried about the town would just take the property by eminent domain.
And also in the news, kind of a related story, CVS is about to take the Zoning Board of Appeals to court.
It is related because it's happening in that building on the Riley Brothers property. Part of the reason Barbara Rushmore wanted the town to acquire the property is because she doesn't like what they want to put in their building there. And the building that is now a Riley's T-shirt outlet at 132 Bradford Street, Steve Riley signed a lease with CVS to move CVS into the building. The town here has a formula business bylaw that enacted in 2010 to keep chain stores out of town. But and on Thursday night last week, about eight days ago, the Zoning Board of Appeals did not grant CVS a special permit that would waive it from the formula of business bylaw, which actually denies CVS coming into that space. But on Tuesday, we found that attorney Jamie Vieira, who's representing CVS on behalf of the Riley Brothers Realty, said that he's going to take the town to court and fight the special permit.
Hmm. And there's some talk about some people are the Outer Cape Health Services pharmacy operation. They're saying that this could be what some people are in favor of it because of they would like the competition for that.
Very few people in town actually want the CVS to come here. A few people do because they think that it will compete with Stop and Shop, but more people fear it coming to town because Outer Cape Health Services says that 50% of its revenue that supports the year-round healthcare center comes from its pharmaceutical sales. And if its pharmacy is challenged by CVS, it probably won't be able to compete, and it could make it difficult for it to continue to run its mammography department, its radiology department, other departments within the building that's needed for the community here. And the majority of the community really doesn't want it. Right now, there's a petition up on the internet, and 799 people have signed it so far, saying that if CVS comes to town, they're not going to shop there, so it shouldn't even bother.
Well, all right. Ann Wood, editor of the Provincetown Banner, thanks for checking in this morning.
Thanks. Have a good week.
All right. And Patrick, we're another story making news. We're still waiting on a decision from the Department of the Interior regarding the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, whether they were going to indeed qualify for reservation land.
Yeah, this decision was expected on Monday, and this obviously ties into the tribe's plans to have a casino built in Taunton on 151 acres that were designated as reservation land or land in trust by the federal government. They had another 170 acres in Mashpee designated such in various parcels. But the focus has been on the land where the casino would be built, especially by neighbors of that land who have sued, you know, essentially the federal government and said that the tribe land into trust decision was faulty. A judge agreed with them, but then sent it back and said, well, you could look at this other way of basically defining the tribe's right to have that land into trust. So the tribe and, you know, the federal government started looking at these two parallel avenues. One was an appeal of the original decision, and one was looking at this other way of categorizing the tribe so that it could take this land into trust for the tribe, the federal government could. The federal government kind of backed off on the appeal and then was supposed to make a decision as to whether they were going to come forward with this other way of basically categorizing the tribe. Again, expected on Monday. They've now said they're going to put it off for at least a week, and it's unclear as to why that's the case, but it does seem like we're going to have to wait a little longer to find out whether the tribe moves forward with its plans or there's some more legal maneuvering. If the federal government does decide to go under this new category, use this new category to take the land into trust for the tribe, the neighbors have promised that they would file a suit on that front as well. The tribe obviously says that if they win that, they're going to start, you know, putting shovels in the ground and get back to work. They had started work on the project and then had been had to stop that work in light of the legal maneuverings.
And it's a big project, a $600 million project that 300 hotel rooms and 3,000 slot machines. So it's a big deal.
Yes, it is. I think they were talking up to $1 billion worth of infrastructure, et cetera, and the casino itself.
Wow. Another story making news. The fungus is controlling the gypsy moths this year.
Yeah, it's my favorite lead of the week. Super fungus to the rescue. we had obviously a lot of problems with gypsy moths in the last couple of years on the Cape and across the state. This is, you know, a creature that basically eats a lot of leaves and can eat so many leaves that trees end up dying over the course of several years. It does better in dry weather, and the reason for that is during wet weather, this fungus that actually does eat the gypsy moths and go after the gypsy moths thrives. And so we've had a drought the last couple of years, and because of that, that's one reason why the gypsy moths have done so well. And there was a pretty stark photo that we had from last year along a road in Wellfleet where all the trees were bare of leaves. There was nothing there. And we went back around the same time, maybe a little bit earlier this year, and took a photo, and all the trees had their leaves. So we were talking to state officials, and they were basically saying this year, we all know that it's been a wet spring, and it's been a little more almost winter-like during this spring than spring-like. But because of that, this fungus has thrived, and it appears to have knocked back the gypsy moths. Now, people will tell you, and I will tell you, that I still have them in my yard, and people in various places say they're still munching away on their trees. It's not everywhere. It's in pockets where that's happening. But overall, state and local officials are saying that generally it's not as bad as it has been.
All right. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup on WCAI. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the News Roundup. On The Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Brian Morris, and with me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is news editor Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And joining us on the phone right now, we have Jim DeRuda joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, Brian.
How are
Patrick.
You? Yeah.
Doing okay.
Jim. Good. Jim, a number of the fishing permits currently held by Carlos Rafael are likely to be redistributed when he's sentenced next month. And Mayor John Mitchell wants to see those permits stay in New Bedford.
Yeah, that's right. Mayor Mitchell thinks that the 13 permits, and he thinks that the boats that will be forfeited too, all should stay in New Bedford. Because he sent a letter to the Assistant Administrator of the Fisheries Service, Sam Rausch, who will go back. He's just there temporarily. He's going to go back to as a regulator, and his replacement will be Chris Oliver, who came from the West Coast and is going to oversee all the fisheries. But his letter to that administrator, Assistant Administrator Rausch, points out that 75% of the groundfish landed in New Bedford comes from Rafael boats and permits. And Mayor Mitchell, John Mitchell of New Bedford, is a former assistant U.S. attorney, and he's kind of invoking some of the regulations and laws he's been experienced with. He's prosecuted some fisheries cases, enforcement cases, and he wants to see everything stay in New Bedford because of that impact of all the ancillary groups, all the welders and net makers and fuel and ice suppliers. At the same time, also this week, the congressional delegation from Maine sent a letter to the Secretary of Commerce asking them, in fact, expressing concern about the mayor's desire to see all those assets stay in New Bedford. They're saying that part of the consolidation of permits that Carlos Rafael perpetrated was by drawing permits from all over, from off the Cape and Maine and Gloucester. So we have this situation rolling up where people sort of taken advantage of or harmed previously by Carlos want a remedy, and he's taken that consolidation and ended up putting others at risk too. So
right, and we should just mention for anyone who may not know that the reason for all this is because Carlos Rafael pleaded guilty to 28 counts, including falsifying fishing quotas, false labeling, conspiracy, and tax evasion. Last March, I believe it was. So that's what's driving this whole situation.
And his impact on the whole fishery, and particularly from my perspective, I'm so worried about what he's done to the scientists who are trying to work and regulators who are trying to work with good science to do what's best for both the fish and the fishermen. And his fraud just undermined that entire system.
Right, they're saying it could have affected the fish, the assessments of the fish stocks as well by a certain percentage. So, a big story. And sentencing, he's going to be sentenced, I believe it's July 28th. So we'll hopefully have. They're saying they may decide the status of those permits at that sentencing. I guess we'll have to wait and see if that actually happens. Jim, another story. Just this week, a North End man was shot and seriously wounded, allegedly by a stray bullet from a gang rivalry. And what are some of the measures being taken in the city to kind of address the issue of gang violence? It's a big deal, I know.
Yeah, well, that 60-year-old fellow who was just sitting in his apartment in broad daylight when a couple of the folks that police like to refer to as knuckleheads,
yeah,
people running around with guns in the daylight near playgrounds, near parks, firing off at each other. These are people who, in general, are under the age of 21. A week earlier, an 18-year-old was murdered right in broad daylight, not far from playgrounds and parks. So, with the onset of summer, children are now out of school in New Bedford. Groups are coming together to try to figure out how to get at this small group of people who just have no regard for this normalcy. It's not a crime wave. It's just a handful of people who've gone too far. So they're trying to pull them back. The police are working very hard trying to get that people to look at the anonymous tip line. If they know that there's a family member with a gun or something like that, they just want that anonymous tip. So that's the first thing they have to do. But also in New Bedford, and I've talked about this before, there's sort of civic infrastructure in New Bedford, the willingness of different groups to work together to set aside the competition for grants, but instead to put some higher goal at the center. Very high capacity for civic infrastructure in New Bedford, including in the South End. So they're pulling together a lot of different programs to try to work. I attended a meeting on Wednesday night from the Denison Memorial Community Center, which is in the South End, which is in one of these neighborhoods where some of this activity takes place. And, you know, this it comes from this Romeo and Juliet thing of three or four generations ago between the South End and the West End, and they're working to try to plug the holes where 14, 15, 16-year-old kids just suddenly
have access to guns and everything else.
Yeah, the program that worked so well for them now seems maybe they want to move on and other allure takes them away.
Yeah, Jim, I know Police Chief Cordero has kind of has been pretty progressive with his sort of community outreach program. Do you think that's helping at all, or is that just one part of a multi-tiered attack on this?
Yeah, it is just one part. And they're doing more than just the outreach, too. They have, they really have adopted the whole philosophy of community policing. They're required to be on their feet in the neighborhood at part of each patrol. But there are a couple grants that have come in. One is a youth initiative that takes at-risk 15, 16-year-old boys and gets them working with police and then working with educators and working with various city entities, because they'll have a stipend,
mm-hmm.
so that they'll have summer jobs and so that they'll have hard work to look back on and even sweat equity in the community.
Right.
So they're taking these kind of tacks and trying to get there.
Yeah. All right. We'll see how that develops over time. Jim DeRuta is editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. And Patrick, story out of Wellfleet, an alpaca farm is pitting neighbor against neighbor up there.
Yeah, and not only neighbor against neighbor, but one of those neighbors is the planning board chairman, Gerald Parent, and his wife, Audrey, who have been told by the Board of Health that they need to take care of smells, grunts, runoff, etc., from their alpaca farm. Their neighbors, the McDonald's, say that it's really a problem. They had some people over recently, and none of them could stay outside because of the barnyard smell there. The McDonald's live right next door, about 40 to 50 feet from the half-acre alpaca pasture that the parents have. And they're not alone. The campers at the Payne's Campground, which is nearby, have asked for refunds and left because of the odors, according to the campground's owners. So the town's health agent went out to the parents' property on June 1st. They actually told the parents on June 1st that they had to come into compliance with their farm animal stable permit, which allows 57 alpacas. It's quite a large number, it seems. But the problem is that they're not adhering to some of the conditions that are part of that permit in terms of how far they are away from the property line and fencing and everything like that, and they're at risk of losing that permit. Gerald Parent says that he's got a different interpretation of the state's laws that relates to kind of the right to farm sort of issues, and he thinks that he's in the right. One of the interesting things is the parents sold the McDonald's their property, and the McDonald's apparently even helped clear the first area for the alpaca
farm. Started
out
kind of amicably.
After all this, it's obviously gone sour between the two neighbors. So they say good fences make good neighbors. I think they need a pretty good one out there in order to right this situation.
All right. Let's go now to Barry Stringfellow of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning.
And Barry, I don't know if bombs away is too hokey a headline for the story, but I guess it seems to fit. Tell us about the exploding bomb on the vineyard this week.
Well, personnel from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers under the formerly used Defense Sites Program have been out here. They've been on Chappie since last March, and they started working this March at the Long Point Wildlife Refuge. And they are finding ordnance that was dropped by World War II pilots in training. And most of them are 3-pound bombs that still have a charge that can do do damage. In fact, one of the people said that initially people were assuming that they were duds, and people on Chappie, they would come up all the time. They called them Chappie doorstops. But they've come out here, and they've found quite a bit of these practice bombs, both in Chappie, and they Tuesday at Long Point, which only recently started, they discovered a 100-pound photo flash bomb. And they had it guarded, and there was no danger to the public, but the Massachusetts Police Bomb Squad and Navy Ordnance Disposal Team came in, and they detonated it safely. But it's an interesting program as far as they've been out here, and they've been finding a lot more than they expected. And the project manager from the Army Corps, Carol Charette, has been doing this 26 years, and it's the biggest project she's ever worked on, and you know you have pilots in training,
yeah,
and so they're going to miss a lot.
And that's what I was going to say. A lot of these guys, you know, they're in training, they're trying to do the thing, and these bombs kind of ended up all over the place.
And right. And since they began work on Chappie, they found 1,700 explosives of concern in Cape Cod Bay, and a little over 1,900 have been excavated from the land. And when the project got started in 2010, they estimated it was going to cost about $5.2 million. Now the price tag is looking more like about $20 million. But obviously it was an issue. In fact, Chris Kennedy, for the trustees of the reservation, said that they had discovered a photo flash bomb, which got the whole ball rolling back in 2008. But shortly after that, he was out on the beach and he heard this clanking noise, and it turned out to be two young boys hitting two of the 3-pound bombs together to get the rust off. So they had to get out of there pretty quick. But yeah, they also are just trying to make the public aware if they find anything, because these things still come up through the sand, to call 911 and recognize, retreat, and report. That's their big three.
Okay, I was just going to say, what are authorities advising people to do if they stumble upon one of these things on the beach?
Just basically, stay away from it and call 911, because even though they're practice bombs, they do have a charge. They estimate about 20% could still be potentially active. So,
yeah, we'll see. All right, Barry Stringfellow with the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right, and Patrick Cassidy is joining us from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. And Patrick, it looks like His Orleans Historical Society is getting set to acquire a historic restaurant in town.
Yeah, it's amazing what can happen from a chance meeting, really. Shelley Hipler Conway, who with her husband runs the Captain Linnell House out near Skagit Beach there in Orleans, just happened to run into Bonnie Snow at the grocery store a couple months back. And Snow is a local historian. She mentioned that the Orleans Historical Society wanted to buy a new collection, but didn't have room to put it in. And Hipler Conway said, well, have you ever thought about buying the Captain Linnell House from us? And that's where it started. They've been working pretty hard at figuring out if it's possible. And just now they've basically voted unanimously on Tuesday to negotiate a purchase and sale agreement where the Historical Society would buy the Captain Linnell House. They're still several years away, and it sounds like it's all fairly amicable, so it's not something that they feel like they have to rush. But they do need to come up with some money, and they're estimating about $5 million to do it. For anybody who doesn't know the Captain Linnell House, it's this stately,
mansion.
It's old captain's house out there. It works as a restaurant, and what would happen if the Historical Society took it over, they would continue to hold events there. It's also a popular wedding venue. And they would continue to do that, but the restaurant area itself would become basically a museum or part of the Historical Society's room that they need for these collections. So it's an interesting deal, and we'll see what happens going forward.
All right. And Patrick, by now it's a yearly familiar ritual, but the great white sharks have returned, and that makes a lot of swimmers nervous, but shark researchers seem to love it.
Yeah, I think shark researchers are excited. They're out there looking for sharks to tag. There's various organizations with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy working with Gregory Scomo at the State Department of Division of Marine Fisheries, or OSearch, which has come in a couple times and tagged some sharks with GPS satellite tags, who tag these sharks. And so what's happened is every year now, you're able to know kind of better when they're arriving back on our shores, and we have a better sense of how many are out there. And some of them have names, and people have kind of given them some personalities. So they are back. Everybody should be aware. But The researchers, as you said, are very excited about that.
All right. I want to thank Patrick Cassidy, news editor of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com, who joined me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Brian.
And thanks to all our other contributors, Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, Josh Bowling of the Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Morris.